This is The Legal Lounge from Lanyon Bowdler Solicitors, where you'll hear about many aspects of law in England and Wales with special guests, industry experts, and local charities. Here's your host, Amanda Jones.
In this episode, solicitors Edward and Claire talk about the role of an attorney. Attorneys manage the estate of a donor whilst they are still alive. Claire is seeing an increase in financial abuse, which comes to light once the donor has died.
Hello, I'm Edward, and I'm joined today again by my colleague Claire Vale. Hi, Claire.
Hello. Hi, Edward.
Lovely to have a chat with you again about things from a more contentious perspective. Disputes and such like, things that in our or my private client practice I don't see on a day-to-day basis, but you're at the sharp end of disputes over wills and estates, aren't you? And that's what you're dealing with every day.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so we're going to talk today about a subject that we touched on before. Neil and I did a podcast where Neil had a couple of very interesting cases to do with abuse of powers by attorneys, where attorneys were really, I mean, it comes down to theft, really, at the end of the day. But they were abusing their powers, taking the money belonging to the donor, applying it for either nefarious ends or completely misunderstanding how they should manage the money that they were meant to be responsible for. The focus today, really, is taking that forward and looking at it from your perspective, which would be you're looking at it when the donor, the person who's granted the lasting power of attorney, has died. So it's financial abuse and lasting powers of attorney, but looking at it through the end of the telescope where this person's now died. And I think what you're going to say is that this is something that's an area that it's becoming more prevalent. This is there's more and more of this kind of stuff going on.
Yes, because obviously the Court of Protection team deal with donors or deputies and attorneys whilst the donor is still alive. But I deal with cases where the donor has died, and then it sometimes comes to light after the death that an attorney has misappropriated funds or assets of the donor. It might be because bank statements have been obtained by the executors, and on looking through those, they can see either chunks of money that have gone missing and they don't know what that money's been spent on, or it might be that there's a whole lot of cash that's been withdrawn. That's quite a frequent one, and wanting to know, you know, well, what was all this cash being withdrawn for? What was it being used for? And so I tend to get involved in investigations into maybe writing to the attorney or former attorney and saying, well, look, you know, these are bank statements that we've obtained. These are, you know, questions that we have about the bank statements. We want to know, you know, what you've spent that money on.
I've had experience of this. It's going back a few years now. It was an estate where it wasn't a super wealthy person, but, you know, they had a fair amount of cash and investments. And after they died, you then started peeling back the layers, and it was clear that money had been going out of a bank account or bank accounts. And you then start to track back and you then think, well, hang on, is there a bit of an issue here? And these payments don't sort of tally up with the kind of situation that we know that this donor was in. You know, that how would they have been making those payments on that debit card in that part of the country where they were quite an elderly person? Then you start backtracking even further. I think in that particular case, we went back 7 years.
Right.
The thing about this, and we've touched on this in another podcast, it's not that difficult to sniff this stuff out because there's an audit trail. You know, there's the bank statements, there's the investments, you know. You can find your way through it, and you just need to get the statements, and you need a spreadsheet and away you go. So but in that particular case, the person who'd, and of course the attorney's powers cease, don't they, when the donor dies? So it was the executor. So in that case, the executor and the attorney were different people. The attorney was somebody who was a beneficiary of the estate. So there was a kind of simple way to resolve yes. it. But we'll, I yes. think we'll come on to yes. that, won't we?
Yes.
So you get a lot of these kind of cases then?
There seems to be an increasing amount right. of them, right. definitely. And I wonder either whether people are, you know, acting as attorneys, they're often not professional people, you know, there might be the children of the deceased, for example, whether they are completely ignorant of the rules relating to, you know, what attorneys can and can't do with the donor's money, or whether they perhaps are determined for whatever reason to just use the, help themselves to the money and use it for whatever they want to use it for.
We're often talking about these kind of issues, and if you kind of picked up the wrong end of the stick, you might say we're trying to make the point that only people, the hallowed people, the lofty solicitors, only solicitors should be dealing with these sorts of things, and you little people, you lay people, shouldn't be dealing with these things yourself. We're not saying that, are we?
We're not saying that, no. And but, in fact, I mean, probably most attorneys are not solicitors. They are family members.
Yeah, absolutely. But we are saying that, you know, as an attorney, before you take on the role, you should really think about the scope.
Well, I think you should, for your own protection as much as anything. You know.
And certainly the donor, so the person who's granting the power of attorney, so we call them, they are called the donor because they're giving the power, they've really got to think carefully about the people they're appointing.
They have, yes.
Really carefully.
Yes, I mean, it's important that you appoint somebody that you really feel that you can trust. Mm. I mean, sadly, in my experience, you would think that you could trust your own children. In my experience, that unfortunately isn't always the case.
No.
But you do need to think carefully about who you're going to appoint. It's often convenient to have a child if you've got children and they're perhaps maybe, you know, one or both of them might be local to you. It tends to be more a professional attorney perhaps where, you know, either there aren't children or children live away, something like that.
We always make that point when we're, because we see a lot of clients and we're advising them to do lasting powers of attorney. We think they're a really, really good thing to do.
Mm.
But you're having to make it quite clear to the donor who you're advising that the flip side of this is that you are bestowing enormous powers
you are,
upon
yes.
your attorneys.
Yes.
You know, the alternative is that you don't grant a power of attorney, but then the risk is that if you lose your capacity, then a court of protection appointed deputy has to be appointed to manage things on your behalf. Now, there are more checks and balances involved in that. That comes hand in hand with more red tape, more compliance.
And delay.
Delay, expense. So, and it may be actually that the person who gets appointed is not necessarily the person that you yourself would have chosen.
Mm.
So we really do think that lasting powers of attorney are an excellent idea because you, whilst you're capable, you say, well, I trust this person or these people to make these decisions on my behalf. I give them the delegated authority if I'm not able to make these decisions myself. But yes, you've got to understand that you're bestowing enormous power. You're giving them the same level of power in relation to, well, we would advise, in relation to all your financial affairs, all your assets, as you yourself would have.
Yes, that's right.
There's a risk. There is a risk involved. And I think the concern is, well, it's not a concern. I think that the data suggests that where there is financial abuse of powers of attorney, which there is, that it's perpetrated mostly by people who are known to the attorney. It's not some distant person who wheedled their way into the affections of the donor and got themselves appointed. It's actually more family members.
More likely to be a spouse or a child.
Is that your experience in the cases that you've seen yourself, Claire, that it's not this person who's descended upon the family or the donor from outside?
No, it's not a stranger or it's not usually a friend even. It's usually a close relation that will be appointed as an attorney.
So important that if you were focusing on, you're looking at this or you're dealing with these or investigating these cases after somebody's died, but jumping back to the advice to attorneys and to the donor creating the power of attorney at the point that they create it, think very, very carefully about the person you're appointed. Do you trust them? If you trust them and you absolutely trust them, then, you know, give them that power. But if there's any shadow of a doubt over whether you trust them completely, just don't appoint them. Even if you think you might upset a child or that relative by not appointing them.
And you can have more than one attorney as well. So, I mean, if you've got more than one child, you might well want to appoint, you know, both children. Yeah. I've seen that that might tend to go wrong, perhaps if you have got one child who sort of steps back and allows the other one to deal with all of mum or dad's finances without sort of doing any checks. Because you can have attorneys who are appointed to act jointly or jointly and severally. So you can have just one of them who's able to act as the attorney. Doesn't mean to say that checks have got to be signed by both of the attorneys, if that's the way the LPA is set up. So there's a danger there if perhaps you've got two children, one of them is looking after mum or dad's finances and the other one is just sort of letting the other one get on with it without doing any checks. And then suddenly, after the death of mum or dad, the bank statements arrive and, oh dear, where's all that money gone? I didn't know that all that money was going out of the account, and what was all of that for? I think if you are an attorney, even if you've sort of got a sibling who's jointly appointed, it's probably a good idea to keep tabs, I would suggest, of, you know, what's what's going on.
And if you are the attorney, and let's assuming you're doing everything that you should be doing and you're not up to anything, because I still maintain that most people would be doing the right thing.
Yes, I'm sure they are.
Even though there'll be these terrible cases. But if you're the person who is dealing with things on a day-to-day basis, and maybe you've got this silent co-attorney who's not and who's letting you get on with it, for your own good, for your own protection, keep really detailed accounts, keep really detailed records so that you can absolutely evidence that everything you're doing is absolutely correct. Because the Office of the Public Guardian, again, this is a contrast, isn't it, between the deputyship and the power of attorney. Yes. If it's a deputyship, then the deputy has to submit an annual account in a prescribed form. But the last in power of attorney, it's a much lighter touch regime. So they're not being required to submit annual accounts. But we would say, well, do keep good records, keep an annual account.
You should,
even though you're not required to submit it to anybody.
Yes, that's right.
Just coming back to that point about more than one attorney and the joint and several things. So we are always recommending to all our clients, because they generally they'll be coming to see us about a will, and then we'll be saying, well, doing the will, not a very nice thing to talk about. So why don't we talk about this other thing that's not very nice to talk about, which is power of attorney. Have you considered doing it? So you recommend, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that we're saying is, well, don't just appoint one person. Make sure you've either got backup or that you appoint more than one attorney and you appoint them on a joint and several basis. Our advice generally is appoint them on a joint and several basis because you've got the backup. You know, if you've got three children and you trust them all, appoint them all on a joint and several basis. And like you said, then maybe one of them can deal with things on a day-to-day basis. Not all of them have to sign all the checks because it's joint and several. But then if that one can't deal with things, they've broken their arm or they're away abroad, the other ones can deal with it. That's the joint and several. The alternative is the joint where everybody has to do everything.
Yes.
And I suppose it's counterintuitive maybe, but most people, if you're discussing this with them, the first thing they'd reach for, I suppose, is doing the joint, because then, oh, well, there's more protection, isn't there? So there's more protection with the joint.
Yes, in that two or more people are having to sanction whatever the transactions are.
But on a practical day-to-day basis,
it may not be workable. So if you've got a parent that lives close to one of the children and then, you know, the other children live elsewhere in the country or abroad.
So, you know, so our advice would generally be, well, in fact, in all cases, it's joint and several rather than the joint. And the other thing with the joint one is, although you've got that control and protection, I suppose, if something happens to one of those attorneys, then, so, you know, the three children are appointed jointly.
Yes.
And let's say they all live in the area, so they can all sign all the checks and they can all do everything together. But then one of them dies or becomes incapable of themselves, then the whole thing falls down because it doesn't just carry on, does it? So the joint and several is the one that we're recommending, but it depends on complete trust.
Yes.
And there is this risk.
Yes.
That
you can't get over that.
You just
really.
Can't. No, you can't. Mm. And Denzel Lush, who was the judge, wasn't he? He was the was he the chief judge at the Court of Protection for years?
I was just thinking about him as you were saying.
And he was a very good speaker. But one of his parting shots as he was retiring was to do a, he either did a talk or he did an article where he's, you know, where he said, I would never recommend anybody to do a lasting power of attorney because I've seen what happens, you know. So all these cases that came before him are terrible, terrible tales of all kinds of financial skullduggery.
Yes.
And as a result of that, he said, well, I'd never do that. I'd always leave it to have a deputyship and have the Court of Protection have that oversight. Mm. But in most cases, it's just sledgehammer to crack a nut. It's a disproportionate way of dealing with things to go to that level.
And it's cheaper, isn't it? Because if you have, you know, if you have a deputyship or a professional deputy or attorney, that's going to cost money. Whereas if you've, you know, if you've got people, children, for example, that you trust, then you can sort of cut out those costs to your estate.
So there's a balance here. You've got to trust the people. And like I said earlier, it's worth repeating it. If there's any, even the slightest doubt over whether you could trust somebody, then do not appoint them as your attorney. Otherwise, give them the widest possible authority.
Mm. Mm.
Okay, so if you're appointed as an attorney, then it's getting back to that point, I suppose, about, you know, well, if you're an attorney and you're doing things correctly, how can you best protect yourself? What must the attorney be careful about doing? I mean, they can't pay themselves, can they,
no.
for just being an attorney?
No, I mean, there are quite strict rules about what you can and can't do with the donor's money and assets. I think the most important principle is that the attorney must act in the best interests of the donor at all times. Mm. You know, the sort of things that really they should be spending the money on would be, for example, you know, making sure that they look after the donor's day-to-day expenditure. If they need shopping, food or whatever, the money can be spent for that. Mm. Clothes, you know, things for the house, that sort of thing. And in addition to daily sort of living expenditure, they can also spend reasonable amounts of money on gifts or donations. But again, it's not sort of, oh, let's give, you know, £5,000 to the RNLI or whoever it happens to be. You know, you
or
need
ourselves.
Could do with a new kitchen.
Yes.
Yes, there are sort of things that you need to take into account as an attorney. So, I mean, if you've got a donor who's sort of made regular charitable gifts, say, to a certain charity or charities, then that sort of thing can continue.
Yeah.
You obviously need to bear in mind what money the donor has got in their estate. Mm. Can they afford for these payments to be made or continue to be made?
Mm.
Things like, you know, family birthdays, if they've got children, grandchildren who they used to give presents or gifts of money to, you know, Christmas as well, that sort of thing can continue as well. You can't, as an attorney, take personal advantage of being the attorney and think, oh, I could do with a new Jaguar now. Mine's a couple of years old. I think I'll get myself a new Jag.
Yeah.
Or, you know, my kitchen's sort of 5 years old now and I could do with the latest granite top surfaces and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Or I think sometimes there's a difficulty in determining what's an individual's money or what's perceived as being family money or what's perceived as being, well, in due course, I would expect to receive this.
Yes.
So this is a bit of an advance on my inheritance. Mm. All these things are, you know, just not, they're not correct. They're not right.
No.
Again, in that podcast that Neil and I did, there was a case where I think it was attorneys rather than deputies had gone on a gifting spree. And their reasoning was that, well, this would in due course come to us. So it's an advance on what we'll get. And they'd rationalised it by saying, well, the donor of the power of attorney is in a nursing home. They have a limited amount. Well, we can crystallise what their day-to-day needs are and their financial requirements. We know they've got this amount of capital. Mm. We know that they're this old. We think they would last for this long.
Yes, I have seen that happen.
Yeah. And therefore, it's okay for us to make these gifts. Well, it wasn't. And it never would be because it's completely out of the scope of the attorney's powers.
That's right, yes.
And the only way you can make gifts over and above that, Christmas gifts, birthday gifts, that sort of thing.
A reasonable amount looking at what the donor used to spend. What they used to spend on
it. Is, you know, the only, you as an attorney don't have the power to determine that. The only authority that would be the Court of Protection, and you'd have to make an application to a judge at the court for them to say that that was okay. And they would be looking at all those things. Well, can you afford this? You know, that's what are you going to have left?
Yes.
How much are you going to need for your care for the rest of your days, which is an impossible,
which nobody knows
exactly. It's not within the attorney's own jurisdiction to determine those things, but I think people forget that, don't they? Or they maybe they rationalize,
they choose to ignore it,
or choose or they just
difficult to know it's what people think.
Sometimes people are just out and out villains, aren't they? But sometimes it's more subtle than that in most cases, but they're kind of missing the point, and they kind of not drawing a distinction between what is clearly the donors and belongs to them and what perhaps they might ultimately inherit. But anyway, it's wrong whichever way you look at it.
Or they might, for example, think, well, in order for mum or dad to get state benefits, looking at the thresholds of capital for that, they might decide, well, actually, if we give a few £1,000 to the grandchildren, then we can get around that problem, which again is wrong and is a deprivation of assets from a legal point of view. Yeah. So, you know, that can't be done either.
That can't be done.
Or to try and avoid care home.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's difficult enough or impossible enough if you're capable and you're doing it yourself. Yes. But for attorneys to think they can embark on that, no, they can't. That's a real minefield. Field, isn't it? Okay. A lot of this, or most of this, I suppose, might only come to light after somebody's died. In your experience, the cases that you've seen when that's happened, are most of them cases where you're able to recover it because the attorney who's taken the money is a beneficiary of the estate, and therefore you can do a clawback in that way? Or is it more often the case that there's no way that you can do an easy clawback like that?
The ideal situation, if I can put it like that, is where the person who's guilty of the wrongdoing is a beneficiary under the will, and the amount that they've wrongly taken comes within their portion of inheritance. So that, I mean, you can't just claw the money back without their agreement, but obviously there's likely to be correspondence between me and their solicitors.
At the very least.
Or maybe court proceedings. Yeah. And then depending on the outcome of that, we can offset the amount that they've wrongly taken from their share of the inheritance. It is much more complicated and difficult, obviously, if they're either not a beneficiary or the amount that they've taken is such that it can't be offset. Mm. And then you're looking at, well, can you, if we go against them personally, have they got the assets to basically fund the repayment?
The shortfall.
I mean, it's a bit difficult if they've spent £30,000 on a new extension on their house and you're trying to get the money back. Mm. It's not impossible, but this
not impossible, but it's much more difficult.
It's much more difficult.
And therefore, potentially proceedings. Yes. And cost, and because time, and therefore legal fees and all the rest of
further
eating into
the
pot anyway, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Let's say we've got cases where it just fortunately it is the case that you can do a clawback because this individual is a beneficiary, and there's enough to cover the shortfall.
Mm.
Are most of those cases, in your experience, you know, you can deal with it amicably, is not the right word, but without too much argy-bargy? There may be a lawyer acting for them on the other side of things, but they fall in line with it. Or more often than not, is it the case that you get pushback, you get argument about
usually,
it.
Usually, it can be quite messy.
Yeah.
For example, one of the things that might be alleged is, oh, well, even though I was the attorney, the donor retained mental capacity and he wanted me to have this money or she wanted me to have this money. You know, they wanted me to have these gifts or, you know, to take this cash out to pay for my spa day or whatever it is, whatever it happens to be. So you get this argument, and then that can become quite complicated, because obviously with an LPA, they're registered at the outset. They're not like the old enduring powers of attorney that were just registered once the donor lost capacity.
Yeah.
They're already there waiting to go.
Yeah.
At some point between the LPA being registered and the death of the donor, if there's an illness or they might have had a stroke or they might have dementia or whatever that affects their mental capacity, you then are getting into the realms of at what point between the registration of the LPA and their death did they lose capacity, if at all? Because if you can be arguing about, well, there's £20,000 that went out before this date. If they retain capacity, it's much more difficult to then you into realms of more sort of coercion and undue influence. So you might be then having to get medical records for the donor or even perhaps getting an expert medical report to try and work out, well, when did this person actually lose capacity? Because it would be after that date, really, when they weren't able to sanction themselves, you know, the various things that were being done by their attorney.
Absolutely. Yes, it would be a rare event, wouldn't it, that in that instance or that kind of scenario you've painted, that the person who's being accused of taking the money would be able to produce a contemporaneous medical report saying, well, they had capacity at this particular point because here's the medical evidence from that time.
So, quite. You
know, saying that they did have capacity to make this particular gift that funded my new kitchen, for example.
I suppose if there's any doubt about capacity, that they could perhaps get a medical report, a doctor's report, just to say, yes, they had, that would be where they've got capacity to actually do that themselves. But if they haven't got capacity and they're thinking of making certain more unusual transactions or there's more money involved, then it may be that an application needs to be made to the court for guidance on that.
No, absolutely. The swings and the roundabouts, or the pros and the cons, isn't it, of the regime that we have with the LPA, that the old EPA, there was this kind of blanket, well, you can use it without registration as attorneys, provided it's set up in that way. But once you lose capacity, that's the point that it has to be registered.
Yes.
Now, the flip side of that is capacity is a kind of fluid thing. It's not a black and white thing.
No.
You might have capacity to make certain decisions and not others. So if we're saying, well, it has to be registered at this point where you've lost capacity, who's determining that? No medical report had to be obtained.
No.
It wasn't satisfactory. It was kind of old-fashioned way of looking at capacity. So then you move into the LPA regime from 2007 onwards, where the LPA has just got to be registered before it's used, but you might retain capacity your entire life and have your attorneys who are helping
That's right.
you.
Yes.
And so it doesn't give any clue as to capacity necessarily.
No, but I had an argument on one of my cases that the donor had capacity to sort of sanction these various payments and money that the attorney had been taking. But when I obtained the medical records, there were two very helpful documents in there, which were to do with the discharge of the donor from hospital following illness, which I think was a bleed on the brain. And these documents painted a picture of the donor being in an extremely bad way. And it was obvious from these documents that there's no way that they had mental capacity to deal with any of these financial transactions that were going on at the time, by the attorney. So we were able to push back on that one and was successful in recovering monies that had been wrongly taken by the attorney.
Excellent. It can be very difficult, can't it, to recover. It's not a straightforward thing. You might be able to easily establish a trail and smell a rat and, you know, actually quantify yes. what's been taken, but it might not be easy to recover either all or any of
no,
it.
No, that's right. Minute.
So another reason for thinking really, really carefully before you enter into the power of attorney as to who you're appointing.
Yes.
But even if they're people who are absolutely, completely trustworthy, there is a risk.
There
but there's
is.
A risk in everything in life, isn't there? All choices that you're presented with, all options, there is, and life is like that. It involves a level of risk, and you've got to balance up the pros and the cons and the risk of doing it or not doing it, haven't you, really?
Yeah. So. And I think if you're the attorney, you need to make sure that you either get some legal advice about operating the LPA, or at least, you know, do some research and find out what the rules are and what you can and can't do. And as you said, make sure that you keep meticulous records, really, and receipts for things. I mean, when I am sort of writing and querying various transactions, well, what was this cash used for that you were withdrawing? Oh, well, you know, either I can't remember, or, you know, they haven't got any receipts, or I, you know, was having work done on the house, but I paid the workman in cash and there's no record of it.
all the good stuff.
I end up having to pay it back.
Yes. That isn't a thing you want to hear, really, is
no,
it?
Or no. Not,
it never holds up well when you say, I was going to be paying them in cash, really. Right. Okay. And all of the things that we've been talking about really are to do with the financial power of attorney. I suppose it's worth saying that as well as doing the lasting power of attorney for property and finances, you can also do a separate lasting power of attorney for health and welfare. They have to be separate. You can appoint the same people if you want. You don't have to. But everything that we've been talking about here has been from a financial perspective.
That's right, yes.
You wouldn't get involved in health and welfare disputes about that. Not so far, okay. I know the Court of Protection team do get involved in the odd health and welfare thing. That's a whole series of podcasts in itself, I would imagine.
Yes.
Again, we touched on the question of whether in certain circumstances it might be good to have professionals as your attorneys because they know their way around things. We're always happy to do that if that's what people really want. Of course, there's a cost to doing that because we're going to have to be paid for dealing with the administration of your affairs under a lasting power of attorney. What we wouldn't be prepared to take on is be attorneys on a health and welfare power of attorney.
No.
And reiterating a point made earlier, we are not saying that you know, it's only going to work if you appoint professionals as attorneys. We're not saying that. It's just thinking about the powers that you're granting, the scope of that, the implications of that if you're the donor of the power, and thinking about what you're taking on if you're an attorney.
That's right, yeah.
And doing a bit of due diligence about that. Mm. Also, just making sure that you're doing things properly. And if you're not sure about whether you can do something, thinking about it, researching it, if need be, taking advice about it.
Yes.
Getting a lawyer involved, checking
That's
off
right.
that you can do it
yeah.
before you go ahead and do it. So
yes.
before you decide to award yourself your Louis Vuitton handbag as an attorney, you know, do some research to see whether that's really within the scope of your powers, or ask somebody who's an expert in this field to just confirm to you that it's not.
Perhaps with property transactions as well. I mean, we haven't really talked about those, but obviously an attorney would have the power to sell the donor's house.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are potential pitfalls and so on regarding those.
Yeah.
I mean, let's say the donor goes into maybe a nursing home and the property is sold. You know, what happens to those sale proceeds? You know, they need to be dealt with properly.
Yep.
What if the house doesn't need to be sold and the attorney decides to put their daughter in there rent free?
Yeah.
You know, for a few years until the donor dies. You know, that's something that would be caught by the rules. That would be considered a gift.
Yes. Yes.
Selling the property at a undervalue. Again, is going to be a gift for that part that's the undervalue.
Yes, all those things have come up. I mean, fortunately, in my experience, where those things have come up, it's been people have could we do this? And so you're saying, well, no, don't do that. There may have been an element of, you know, well, we're concerned about the nursing fee. So if we bought the property, but we buy it for this.
Yes, that's it.
Well, hang on a minute. Yes. No, because that's an undervalue. So there's a gift element. That's not within the scope of your power. So you can, you know, provided the power of attorney allows you to do it, which we would advise that it does. It does not restrict you from doing this. The attorneys would be able to sell and buy, you know, sell the property, buy a replacement property, or buy an investment portfolio, but they are very restricted in the gifts that they can make. Coming back to my point about a Louis Vuitton handbag, I actually don't know what the cost of the Louis Vuitton handbag is, but I'm thinking it's probably quite a bit more than what you would normally be in the habit of giving somebody for, say, Christmas or birthday.
I'm sure.
Which is why I think it's ultra vires in terms of the gifting powers of the attorneys. But yeah, all of those sort of scenarios are things that we've seen. And yeah, yes, fortunately, people's taking the advice, maybe being disappointed to find out that they can't do it, maybe knowing in their heart of hearts that it would have been difficult, complicated, or impossible, and going away a bit sad, but at least they've taken the advice before they went down the route and kind of made a complete hash
of it. That's right, yes.
Thanks to Edward and Claire for sharing their expertise. Yet more proof that lawyers don't bite. If you have a legal issue you'd like me to put to our team to cover in an upcoming episode, please let me know by visiting lblaw.co.uk/podcast. Thanks for listening. If you found the conversation useful, please remember to follow or subscribe on your app so you're notified of new releases when they come out every Monday. Speak to you next week.
That was The Legal Lounge from Lanyon Bowdler Solicitors. Visit lblaw.co.uk/podcast for helpful resources, and please do follow or subscribe on your podcast app so you never miss an episode.